This talk is given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard, a writer and lay teacher based in Panama City, Panama. Zuise is also the guiding teacher of the Ocean Mind Sangha, a virtual community of Zen practitioners. And this talk, like all of her talks, is offered freely. If you'd like to offer a donation to support Zuise's work, listen to other talks, or find out more about the Ocean Mind Sangha, please visit us at oceanmindsangha.org. Thanks for listening.
So, good evening, everyone. We are beginning our study of the miracle of mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh, or Thay, as he was known to his students, is the equivalent of sensei for us. It means teacher, as you read in the book. And, you know, we're completing our first week of Ango, right? We entered together 7 days ago. 7 days ago, we essentially promised ourselves that we would spend them here in our bodies, here in our minds, here in this moment, the only moment in which our lives are taking place. 7 days in which we lovingly and deliberately gave ourselves permission to be completely ourselves. Because this is really what it means. And isn't this what we want, right? What we all want. I know that I certainly have wanted this most of my life, and I saw it in my teachers before I even knew really anything about anything. I recognized the quality in them. They were fully themselves, and I wanted that. I wanted to completely be who I am, to let you be completely who you are. No masks, no hidden parts, no unwanted bits that we feel we have to relegate to some dark corner of our lives. Elsewhere, Thay gave another teaching that really touched me. Actually, it didn't just touch me, and it went in deep. And I just kept turning it in my mind, you know, like you would turn a beautiful piece of handmade pottery. You know, it was like I wanted to feel it under my fingers. I wanted to see every last detail of it. And the teaching was this: when I love you, I maintain my freedom. I respect my freedom. So take that in for a moment and expand it so that it includes you too. When I love me, all parts of me, I maintain my freedom. I respect my freedom. So what's on the other side of that thought? Now, doesn't it say by implication that when I don't love you, when I don't love myself or any part of myself, I lose my freedom, right? I disrespect my freedom. I go against my freedom. How is that? And then freedom from what? Freedom from whom? How do we keep ourselves bound? I was reading a story, you know, how sometimes stories just land at the right time. Or maybe you make connections in your mind. And it was two Indian women who unexpectedly fell in love in Nepal. One of them had left home and was working at a hostel, and the other came to stay there during what she thought was one last solo trip before she got married to someone her parents had arranged for her. And so both women were gay, but while one accepted it, the other one did not. And as this second woman was headed toward this marriage she did not want, a marriage that she somehow thought would make her right in her mind, give her the kind of life she thought she wanted, certainly the life that was expected of her, and not without reason. I mean, same-sex relationships were illegal in India until 2018. Her parents had all but disowned her when she came out, refusing to accept all parts of who she was. And so as she was thinking of this coming marriage, she pictured herself in an ocean. She said she felt like she was swimming as far away from herself as she could and was unable to find safe harbor anywhere. And I like that image because I think it's so on point. It so describes what it's like when we don't admit, when we won't admit some part of ourselves. It's like we are set adrift in a vast ocean and there's no land in sight. It's like we've been separated from our own land, from our own ground. And so we get lost. We lose track of who we are because there's some part of us lost somewhere. And we don't know in which direction to swim or why. And so I don't mean, you know, sexuality specifically, but just who we are in our being, in our truth, in the beingness of our being and any part of that. Because when we aren't whole, we are adrift. We're in pieces. And no one can live like that. Not well. Just as no one can float forever. You know, at some point you need to walk on the ground. And so, despite their culture, despite their families, the women decided to forge ahead and they formed the relationship. And they thought, why don't we move to the United States? We can more freely be who we are there. And one of them got a job in San Francisco. And they made a promise to themselves, to each other, that they would not look, let alone cross it, that they would not even look at the Golden Gate Bridge until they could do it together, because it was a symbol of the life they were working so hard to build. Such an interesting promise, if you think about it. Premise, too. I promise you, I will not look at this iconic 4,200-foot-long structure, almost 800 feet tall, and it's red. I vow to not see it until I can see it with you. It's a little bit like saying, I will not go on to attain enlightenment until I can do it with you. And so one of them goes ahead. She has the job. She moves to San Francisco. And then COVID strikes. India is shut down like the rest of the world. And the woman who stayed behind is stuck at the airport. She had already checked in for her flight back to Nepal so she could get her stuff together and apply for her visa to the US. And so now she's stuck at the airport with no family, nobody she really knows. She knew a couple of people from her partner, but not enough to ask for help. Now fiancé, because after being together, they've gotten engaged. She's stuck in San Francisco when she gets a call. And it's her mother on the line. And she says, we heard what happened to your girlfriend. Does she have a place to stay? They hadn't even been talking to each other, the parents and the daughter. But when she said, no, she doesn't, they said, she is family, because you are family. And so tell her to move in with us. When I love you, I respect my freedom. I maintain my freedom. And she stayed with her future in-laws for 10 months. And in the meantime, her girlfriend back in San Francisco did everything she could not to look at the Golden Gate Bridge. She would drive around. One time when she could not avoid it, she asked her coworker to switch places with her and to drive. And then she sat through the whole thing with her eyes closed because she had made a promise. She had made a promise and she was going to keep it. And she did. When I love you, when I love myself, I respect my freedom. When I see you and not my idea of you, when I respect you, I do not suffer. When I don't see you, when I don't see myself, I do suffer. And most likely, I will make those around me suffer. It's actually very simple when you look at it in that light. And so all we have to do just is to be fully here, to see what is there, to see you with respect, to see me with respect. That is the miracle of mindfulness. It's not that you eat very slowly a tangerine, although you might do that. Is that you slowly love your way into your own being and therefore your life. Just awakened, I hope that every person will attain great awareness and see in complete clarity. First thought when opening your eyes in the morning. The teacher that Thich Nhat Hanh quotes. Washing my hands, I hope that every person will have pure hands to receive reality. Let me respectfully remind you, life passes swiftly. So whether we call these gathas or mantras or vows, these rather simple statements create a monastery of consciousness. And as Thay says, they awaken our minds. And so can we see that to wash the dishes, just to wash the dishes, is a profound expression of love, of reverence? I got a huge deja vu as I was reading this again, because Daido used to use that phrase all the time, Daido Roshi. You can wash the dishes to have clean dishes, or you can wash the dishes to just wash the dishes. And he never once attributed Thay. I am so sorry on behalf of him. But can we see that this is a profound expression of reverence? That when we wash the dishes in this way, we awaken our minds. So this means we can't really say we have no time for practice. Right? I mean, that's like saying I have no time for living. Because we just have to turn to the moment that's right here. Enter that moment with mindfulness. So that eating a tangerine slice or teaching a class to a bunch of rowdy kids or making phone calls to people who don't think at all like you is an expression of love, of life. There was a time when I thought I didn't have enough time. There was just too much to do. And it all felt important. And so I just rushed. I just rushed from one thing to the next, feeling like there couldn't be enough hours in the day if you doubled those hours. That I couldn't do everything I needed and wanted to do. Until I began to wonder why I also felt so anxious. Why I felt so trapped in my life. Why I was so ill at ease all the time. Why I was perpetually exhausted. And the question that I asked myself over and over again, why am I not at peace? Why am I not at peace? Remember that koan? Wicca goes to Bodhidharma. This is after he has stood in the snow and cut off his arm to prove how serious he is about practice, about the Dharma. He says, "My mind is not at peace. Please set it at peace for me." I'm pretty sure the part about him cutting off his arm is not true. But the fact that it's told about him and that he stood outside the monastery in the snow just gives you a sense of him. He was not a laid-back kind of guy. Wicca wasn't. And so he goes to his teacher and he says, "I am not at peace. Please set my mind at peace for me." And the first time I read it, I thought he was just like being lazy or arrogant or something. It's like, you know, please take care of this for me because I can't do it or I won't. But then I tried to get inside Wicca's mind. And then I began to feel, I think he's actually desperate. He's saying what I'm saying. I'm not free. And I want to be. I'm not free, and something tells me that you are. That's what I see. That's what I feel. So can you help me? Can you please help me? Because I've tried all of these different things, and I'm not happy. I don't even know who I am. And so Bodhidharma helps him. Bodhidharma, fulfilling his vow, says to him, "Bring me your mind and I'll set it at peace for you." And Wicca goes looking. And the transmission of the lamp, where this koan appears, says in one line, he searches and searches for the mind and he cannot find it. One line in one text that we know, if we've been there before, packs days and months and years, perhaps, of angst, of struggle, of despair, and determination. Because we're not told of Wicca's sleepless nights. We're not told of the many meetings he had with his teacher, and he was turned away. Not yet. Keep looking, go deeper. We don't hear how discouraged he felt, the times he decided to give up, the times he decided in disgust, "This is not for me, I am not doing this anymore." But there was still this thing. I am not at peace. He could not pretend otherwise. And so he goes looking. My mind is not at peace. Why is that? Think of what's happening in Sudan right now. Think of what's happening in Ukraine, in Israel, in Venezuela, in the US. All of that conflict, all of that division, all of that unrest. is exactly the same unrest in our own minds. And there might be those who would say, you know, meditation can't touch our geopolitical problems. It's too little for far too much. But laws and policies are conceived by human minds. Embargoes, restrictions, war declarations. All brought to being in a human mind. When I don't respect any part of you, I don't respect my own freedom. I do not maintain freedom. So how we got here is not a mystery. What is a mystery, at least as far as I'm concerned, is why do we persist in doing what doesn't work? As Einstein said, that is the very definition of insanity. We would say delusion, to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. War will never lead to peace, no matter how long we try. Only peace can nurture itself. Like a group of kids, of American kids, who brought flowers and candy to an English class in Springfield, Ohio. A class in which many of the students were the Haitian immigrants Trump and Vance had denigrated just days before. And they brought signs that said, "We love you. We welcome you here. We stand with you." And thus we maintain our freedom, yours and mine. And so Huica searches and searches for his mind, looking for the way to peace. And finally, he goes back to Bodhidharma and says, "I've searched. I've looked everywhere and I cannot find it. I cannot find this mind." And Bodhidharma says, "There, I've set it at peace for you." And at that, Huica attained liberation. How? If we're supposed to be awakening the mind through mindfulness, through concentration, through loving kindness, how are we going to do it if we can't even find it? We can't even locate it. There, I've awakened it for you. You see? What do you see? Why don't you tell me? That's not a rhetorical question. Yes, sure so.
I was looking at, as I started the reading, I was looking at what keeps me, what prevents me from being mindful. So what is it that, what is happening when I'm not mindful? And why is that seem easier? Hmm. And one of the things that came to me was that with some awareness come a lot of things that maybe I don't want to face. And so it feels easier, maybe, seems easier. I can't even say that because I don't know why exactly it happens, but it seems more challenging to be aware, to be present, and to be mindful. And as soon as what's very interesting, and as it relates to this question of mind and what that is and where we find that, is that when I do find myself in a mindful state and something that I don't want to see arises, that's where the trouble arises. When I'm mindful, I'm not thinking about my mind at all. When the trouble arises, now I'm thinking of my mind. And I'm immediately gone from mindfulness and spinning around what to do with what I don't want to see.
And so what's the antidote for that?
I was walking the dog today asking myself just that question. And it's really it's like layers of mindfulness, right? So it's breathing in, I'm seeing something I don't want to see. Breathing out, I'm resisting it and turning away. Breathing in, I'm resisting it and turning away. Breathing out, it's resolving. Breathing in, I'm walking the dog. Yeah. But sometimes it's multifaceted, and it keeps really, it's like staying with it. It's like this commitment to stay with the mindfulness through those layers.
Yes. I mean, you actually described it very nicely. You know, I started a practice recently. It's very simple, but not so much for me. Not always. And it's to, when something comes, to say, thank you, yes. Or thank you, I accept. And I find that it helps a little bit to kind of go from one of those layers to another. Not always, when I don't want to accept. But I'm thinking of an image that is not coalescing, but it's like a nice, you know, it's like when you have a solution, catalyst, that's what it is. It just like an electron jumping from one ring to another is like the thing that is like, okay, you don't have to have a whole discussion in your mind. Yeah. Just yes, I accept. Thank you. What else? Yes, Elliot.
Just to clarify, could you repeat the initial question?
It was really just a general question. I said, what do you see? But really, the general question is anything that you would like to bring up about, anything that you would like to bring up about what we've been reading. But one thing that I was going to say, just so I don't forget it, it sparked when you were talking, Ryu-san, that's the reason main reason why I chose to pair this book on loving kindness with this book on mindfulness. Because when what you describe happens, Ryu-san, which I think is exactly right, you know, that often we don't want to be there because we don't like what we see. That one way to work with it is through love, through self-love, through loving that part, that person, that bit that I don't want to love, to practice that love so I can be, if not closer to it, I can at least stay in its presence a little longer. So it was a general question, Elliot.
Yeah, I thought we were talking mostly about the Bodhidharma Huayqiao koan.
If you want to say something about that, please do.
No, well, I don't know. But one of my favorite little sections of the Miracle of Mindfulness that we read is when Thich Nhat Hanh calls it a rite, when he talks about these rites, I don't remember exactly the context he used, and he said, I hope that something like, I hope that doesn't seem too severe or too harsh, but it brings up the life and death matter of awareness. And I feel like, for me, it's not so much that maybe that I don't think at least that it's, I don't want to be aware of what's going on in me. It's almost like, I have habitual tendencies of being addicted essentially to judging others, to layering on stories, to thinking, to resisting. In Bhante Ji's book, in one of the chapters I just read yesterday, he was saying that like the appropriate response to anger isn't more anger. The appropriate response to anger is loving kindness. And so what stops me from being present and one-minded is because I've spent my whole life being more scattered and jumping from one thing to the other, whether I want to or not, or whether I'm conscious of it or not. And to train myself in being present is a continual effort. It's just natural to be not focused in one point.
Yeah, it's work, right? I mean, if you really think of this booklet that Tai was describing, and they have one actually, Plum Village has a book of gathas, where you know every time you're taking an action, you say this little verse. It's a lot of work, but imagine living like that, you know, with that degree of presence. And so, you know, it's like Ryusan was saying, why does it feel easier in a sense to not be present? Well, you know, because if I'm seeing my own anxiety or insecurity or pettiness or selfishness, wherever it is, it seems easier to be all up in your business. I don't want to look at what I'm doing, you know, why don't I just look at what you're doing and spend some time entertaining myself with that? So it takes also some courage and quite a bit of honesty to be willing to turn the light around, as we say in Zen. Kaito.
I sort of like to pick up on what Ryu-san said a little bit, but I think as you and I discussed the other day, the first thing that struck me when I was reading this book was the story he told, that Tai told about his friend Alan, who just felt, I never have any time for myself. And as you were describing, I'm being pulled in all these different directions and I don't have time for my life. And realizing as he was taking care of one of his children, oh, this is my time. There is no my time and their time and other time. And the pulling is in the mind, is not by circumstances. It's by dividing. And how he suddenly saw, I have all the time in the world because this is all my time. And really tried to work with that. You know, as simply this evening, I was picked up Helen from daycare, and we coming home, and I needed to get in, and I wanted to start preparing dinner, and because I knew I was going to be coming here, and she was doing some baloney in the car and wanted to, you know, swing around and look at, and I was just I need to be, and I just said, wait a second. Just stop and just stop and like to take this anxiety, just turn it down a little, just take a breath, and here I am. This is my life right now. I don't, so we'll see what happens if I'm a little late getting dinner, right? And suddenly it was a delightful moment when that it could have been just me getting more and more frustrated. I've been very frustrated in that situation. Not that I get really angry, but just feel like I'm neither here nor there. And instead, I was just here. Yeah. And it's a relatively easy one because it's, you know, my daughter and I love her. It's harder when it's difficult, really difficult situations.
Yeah. Yeah. But that is why we practice when it's easy, right? As my teacher often says, you know, when we don't separate between moments, between people, you know, I was kind of joking, but I wasn't joking that we're all Sankai. You know, we're all Ryusan, we're all Kaito. When we don't separate, it is all me and it is all my time. How amazing, how wonderful. And I never have to worry about running out of time. I have more than I need.
And, you know, something else that we were talking about, you know, what do you do with these thoughts? I mean, an image that sort of for some reason came to me today as I was taking a walk was that what I do with thoughts that, you know, when they're, I see a situation and I feel upset about a situation, but it's thought I'm having. And what I'm doing is I'm chasing that miserable, unhappy thought, chasing it. But what I'm doing is telling myself that this thought is yanking me around by the nose and going, ouch, ouch, stop, 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 you know, but it's not yanking me around by the nose. I'm running after it. I'm chasing it. And stop chasing.
Yeah, I think the moment where you really see that, it changes everything. So remember that.
I'll try.
Kurt.
Yeah, you know, Tai was one of my earliest teachers, and I think, you know, what Ryusan was talking about with it, that it's difficult to be mindful, and it seems more difficult to be that. It seems easier to be mindless, and I think in a way is because it definitely does feel that way, because you're not just fighting an attention, you're not just fighting distraction, you're fighting a lifetime of habitual energy, of conditioning, both put into you, you've put on yourself. And it's like a swift, white, rapid river with, you know, rocky, that mindfulness is like trying to swim against that. And sure, it's a lot easier to let go and get swept away, but you're going to get beat up pretty bad against the rocks and then wonder why, you know. And keeping in mind that our mind is this thing too that we've been taught is a thing. We have it. We own it. It is us or part of us. And this idea is so insidious that we can't imagine it not really being a thing. It not really being something we can't taste or touch or smell, because it seems to be everywhere for us, right? But we can't.
Yeah, that's why we need a different way of seeing, because it's we can't conceive of it. And the mind is like a sword can't cut itself. So it's like the mind cannot grasp itself fully. Fully. But that's the fun of it. That's the thing you have to learn. Jess.
Just a small thing. I have always loved the idea of gathas, and I actually have that slim volume of Thich Nhat Hanh's gathas. And I always have struggled to not just to remember what they are, no matter how short I keep them, but then to remember to do them at all. But just this ango, I have started doing something that is essentially to serve the same purpose, which is working better for me, which is just whenever I'm doing something to, in my mind, say, or out loud if I'm alone, say, this is whatever the thing is, and then put practice on the end of it. So for instance, this is kitchen practice, this is toothbrushing practice for my 2.5-year-old daughter who's destroying the house, this is Bluma practice, you know, just like whatever it is. And yeah, for me, that it serves, it's not exactly the same as a gatha, because it doesn't, I think, have that sort of also that prayerful quality to it, but I'm finding it helpful. It's like the simplest thing that I can, the simplest way of coming to the moment.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. Yeah, come in.
Yeah, so I've been working with the breathing, the breath, really deepening my breath with this, which has been really helpful. So sorry, my neighbor who assaulted my other neighbor came over and assaulted me verbally today, right before the mid-morning zazen. So I sat down not wanting to breathe, not wanting to practice. And I sat and I focused on my breath, and I said, I need to do metta for this person. Nothing in me wanted to do metta for this person, not at all, not one ounce. And I did for half an hour. I did metta for this person. And interestingly, and I don't think it would have happened otherwise, three of my neighbors, all women, invited me over, and we came together, and we were all very present for each other. And we just basically held each other up and just allowed it to, you know, to settle. And so we settled. And I'm not altogether sure I would have been able to do that had I not practiced metta. And I realize I need to do that. And no matter what, no matter how hard it is, I have to hold this person in love. Because if I don't, then I'm not loving myself.
I can't possibly add anything to that. And last one, Marguerite.
Well, when I was, when I had done the loving kindness, read that book, and I was doing the loving kindness so genuinely, I was so happy and I was feeling it. Then comes the Thich Nhat Hanh book, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to label everything I'm doing. I'm driving, I'm stopped at a light, I'm walking into the gym. And it was like, made it so easy. I was like, at ease. And I'm doing this. And then it seemed like it was just, I just wondered, I was saying the right things at the right time. And I thought, what, who's saying this? How come it's so easy? And then all of a sudden it all stopped. And I thought, damn it, now life is getting in my way. I want to go back to this wonderful spot of just being with everything that's happening. And the labeling of it made it joyful. I was just so happy. But I remember when it switched and I thought, oh, darn, life is getting in my way. So I go back to labeling everything I'm doing, you know, like picking up this cup of coffee, talking to you, wanting to say congratulations to Tess and Israel. I was felt so close to you. I felt like I was there. I couldn't believe you're so far away and in Israel. And it was a remarkable experience sharing this with you. I wanted to say that. So that's it.
Thank you, Marguerite. You said something. That it is actually a practice, a Theravada practice called noting. And it's mentioned in the Anapanasati Sutta, you know, and I've quoted from the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, a practitioner knows when they're walking, they know that they're walking. When they're standing, they know that they're standing. When they're taking in a long breath, they know they're taking in a long breath. So it's a, you know, Thay is taking Theravada practices and tying them, especially later on, he does more concertedly to Zen, And I think that's also why it works, because it's the ground of everything. So I won't go into deeply into the Anapanasati Sutta, but it's basically, it takes, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness are of body, of thoughts, of feelings, and mental formations. And the Anapanasati Sutta is just of breath. And so it gives you that 16-way formula for working with the breath. And I would suggest if you want to spend a little bit of time with it, to try some of the practices that he describes. Some of them we do as part of our own training, like counting the breath or following the breath. But there's some subtleties there. And yeah, I would just suggest that you try and see what happens.
For more talks, to get more information about Zuise's teaching, or to join her email list, visit us at oceanmindsangha.org.